Michael.
Peter.
What do you know about political pundits?
All I know is that the only job easier than their job is doing a podcast about political pundits.
So we were bouncing around premium content.
Oh.
For our dedicated listeners, our paying customers.
Hello.
You know, we are, at the end of the day, a media criticism podcast that has sort of taken a firm position against opinion columnists.
An anti-pundit position, anti-pundit stance.
And so what better way to highlight that stance and dig in than to have a series where we explain some to each other and to our audience.
Where we introduce each other to specific pundits and their punditry.
Yeah, because I think a lot of these people sort of blend together in my mind, right? Where I have a sense that if I hear a name, oh, that's a dummy.
Yeah.
I couldn't quite pin specific opinions on them.
Also, I think there's something interesting with punditry and maybe with like everybody on the internet where it's like they just come to you fully formed. You're like, this is just a political pundit whose views I'm hearing. And oftentimes you don't know like, wait, who is this person?
Yeah.
I feel like this is also an opportunity to like go into the background of some of these people.
Yeah. Although I won't be doing that too much.
Okay. I was subtweeting my own segment, but maybe we're not going to do that for years.
Well, my pundit portrait is Kathleen Parker, columnist for The Washington Post, who is pretty distinctly uninteresting in terms of her history.
Just like as a person.
Now, what do you know about Kathleen Parker?
I literally know nothing. You said you wanted to start this series with some like more obscure pundits. And like, this is as obscure as it gets. I literally know her name and where she works. That's it.
Yeah, she's at the Post. She's been a columnist since 1987. She started off with the Orlando Sentinel, eventually makes her way to the Post where she remains, because that's the kind of job you get and you die with. It's like a Supreme Court appointment.
It is really weird to me that like this is just like background noise of these fucking columnists, that they just have their jobs for life.
And you will see as we go through some of her greatest hits, it doesn't matter how wrong you are.
Yes.
If anything, being wrong about a past column, that's a new column.
Yeah.
So she's now like just over 70 years old, so has spent like half of her life as an opinion columnist in major newspapers. And you can see the effects of that on her brain. She's mostly just like a generic moderate Republican, which I guess is sort of like the most common kind of opinion columnist, right?
Mm-hmm.
She is really just sort of a window into the politics of like insulated, wealthy suburban Republicans.
Mm.
I have selected some writings of hers to show you. It's possible that when I send you these columns, you will remember it.
I just love that the editors of these pages are like, we've heard from lots of people who are correct about things, but what about balance? What about the people who are incorrect all the time?
Well, that's what's great about the selection that I'm going to show you, because Parker does have plenty of like just dumb, fluffy columns in the same way that most columnists do, right? Mm-hmm. She's very weird about race in like a very conventional, older white person way.
Black, white, or purple.
But what I think sets her apart a little bit is her willingness to make very bold and specific predictions.
Ooh.
Leading to her being proven very wrong repeatedly and publicly for years on end. I'm going to drop a piece that was published by her on November 4th, 2016.
Okay. Oh, nice.
Go ahead and read me that headline, if you will.
It says, "Calm down, we'll be fine no matter who wins." And it's a photo of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
This is right before the election, and she's just being like, can you all relax?
Everyone chill out. Everything's basically the same. Nothing matters.
She says, "As November 9th dawns, Americans are sure to be mad as hell. Those happy with the victor will be re-angry soon enough when they realize they won't be getting what they were promised. This is the good news. Thanks to the brilliance of our tripartite government, nobody gets to be a dictator."
Hell yeah.
"And despite what nearly everyone seems to believe, our, quote, broken government works pretty well most of the time."
I love that it's like, I've dedicated my life to political punditry, and also politics doesn't really matter, you guys.
I'm going to send you specific excerpt.
I like that mine is like this kind of three-dimensional, like tragic figure, and yours is just like a one-dimensional dunk fest. Just like, look how much this lady sucks.
If you go into a pundit portrait looking for three-dimensional characters, you're not going to find that many.
I've misunderstood the brief, potentially. Okay. She says, if Trump wins, he'll be held more or less in check by the House and Senate because that's the way our system of government is set up. Not even Republicans are eager to follow Trump's lead. There won't be a wall. He won't impose any religion-based immigration restrictions because even Trump isn't that lame-brained. He'll dress up and behave at state dinners and be funny when called upon. He'll even invite the media to the White House holiday party. He won't nuke Iran for rude gestures. He won't assault women. He and Vladimir Putin will hate each other respectfully. Holy shit. This is like 8 for 10 of just like wrong predictions.
How like you could flip 100 coins and never, you know what I mean? This is just an insane series of really terrible predictions and they don't make sense. Like, there won't be a wall.
There already is a wall.
Is a wall. And that's sort of, that was like a big part of like the serious people critique of Trump, right? He won't impose any religion-based immigration restrictions because even Trump isn't that lame-brained. What is that supposed to mean when this was like one of his primary campaign promises, right? The Muslim ban.
He literally, the nuking Iran is the only one that she was right about. All the other ones are arguably... Like, she says he and Vladimir Putin will hate each other. Well, that's not really true. I mean, I guess he didn't assault women in the White House, but we know of.
Right.
He assaulted, it appears, every other woman he's interacted with.
I love that that is, like, don't worry. Donald Trump won't assault women in the White House. Like, I wasn't, like, particularly worried about that, I guess.
Yeah, it's not the specific, like, location of the assaulting that bothers me. Yeah.
This is what makes pundits so special. They can just be like outrageously bad at their job, not just in view of their bosses, but in public, in view of everyone.
This is cannibalizing my little pundit section. But like, there's also the thing of like, why is it their job to predict stuff, right? It's like, I think this person's going to win, or like, this is what's going to happen. Well, why don't we just like wait and see what happens? I just, the whole project of people thinking that their job is to tell people what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's just very odd to me.
This reminds me of a, and I'm sorry to say something that you will relate to so little, but this reminds me of like a football game pre-show.
Oh.
When the talking head football analysts make their predictions about who's going to win. And you might think about it rationally and be like, well, why the fuck are we even listening to this? The game is about to happen.
Yeah, just
wait. The game is about to happen. Let's watch the game. Yeah. But of course, what's actually happening is that they are just doing it as entertainment.
Every relationship I have with a straight person eventually culminates in them explaining sports commentary to me.
Here's how I've explained sports to straight women. Mm-hmm. I will ask if they do straight women stuff like watch Bravo.
Okay.
Do they talk about Bravo shows with their friends? Maybe like The Bachelor, right?
Yeah.
The only difference between straight men and straight women in this regard is that I think you can get most straight women to admit that that stuff is stupid.
Yeah.
Whereas men will try to convince you forever that there is something about sports that is somehow important.
It is 8:45 a.m. and I've watched 3 makeup tutorials. So I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I don't also imbibe frivolous commentary.
I think that is sort of quintessential Kathleen Parker. And the only thing I can say in her favor here is that in 2020, she apologized for this take.
Oh, did she? Okay. Yeah.
She was like, okay, look, I got it wrong. Although what she sort of focused on was like, look, he has sort of eroded and undermined these very important institutional norms. And she was also very critical of his coronavirus response. Mm. And so she's like, okay, sorry, I got that wrong. She wasn't like, oh, by the way, he did, in fact, take steps to ban Muslims from entering the country, you know.
Like sentence by sentence, yeah.
Right. Like the actual things that she got like materially incorrect, she doesn't really address.
I also think it's very funny with Trump specifically, too, that it's like the actual pundit view over and over again is like, yeah, he says he'll do a bunch of authoritarian stuff, but it's not going to happen. Right. Like, shouldn't the fact that he's saying authoritarian stuff constantly, like, that seems like a really big deal. Like, we haven't had that before.
How can you tell me that bad things are going to happen when a bad thing has never happened to me in my entire life?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's step forward a couple of years. September 18th, 2018, Kathleen drops a heater. This is during the Brett Kavanaugh nomination drama. He's in the midst of his confirmation hearings, and they have been sort of derailed by a very credible, very detailed accusation of sexual assault made by Professor Christine Blasey Ford. Kavanaugh, of course, denies the accusation. And then before either Ford or Kavanaugh so much as testified, we get this piece, which I'm going to send you.
Oh, no. It says, is there a Kavanaugh doppelganger? Was this fucking deranged thing where it's like she misidentified someone who was also there and it was based on like Google Street View analysis?
That's the Ed Whelan spinoff from this op-ed. That happens after.
Okay.
But this is basically Kathleen doing, I don't want to call it analysis. It's something less than that. But Kathleen is trying to square two things in her brain. One, she is not a psycho on like sexual assault issues generally. Mm-hmm. So when she hears an accusation, she doesn't think like, oh, this is fraudulent.
Right.
Right. She believes her. But Kavanaugh has put out a statement denying that it happened.
Right.
And Kathleen Parker is a Republican who likes Brett Kavanaugh.
Right. But also she wants him to get confirmed. So
yeah. How can you hold both of these thoughts at once? And where she lands is, what if it wasn't Kavanaugh, but someone who looked like him?
So she just like made this up?
This is made up. Here's a quote. As crazy as this sounds, it wouldn't be unheard of. And given the high regard in which Kavanaugh has been held throughout his life, including during high school, it would make the most sense. Could there be a Kavanaugh doppelganger? The most sense, Michael. The most sense.
I love thinking of all news events as basically like a short story prompt.
Yeah.
Just like, well, what if?
Kathleen continues. Could there have been another Kavanaugh-ish looking teen at the house that night who might have attacked Ford?
You've got to be kidding me.
Cases of mistaken identity are far from rare. People with the same name are often confused, as was the case with Ford herself. On Monday, Drudge Report tweeted a link to an article on another site that seemed intended to discredit her with negative comments by her former students. But it turned out that the reviews pertained to another California professor named Christine Ford.
Wait, what? This has nothing to do with anything. Mistaking someone's name is not the same as mistaking someone's appearance.
You have to really think about this, because this is an incredible feat of reasoning. The Drudge Report, of course, essentially a far-right gossip blog that is a one-hit wonder. They broke the Lewinsky scandal.
Mm-hmm.
So once these accusations were public, they try to smear Professor Ford. But they misfire, and they end up smearing some other random professor who has a similar name.
Right.
Parker is using this as evidence against the veracity of Ford's testimony.
Right.
When what it actually is evidence that people on the right were engaged in like a shameless effort to discredit Professor Ford.
Right.
An effort that Parker is participating in right now.
Yeah, she's now joining this effort. Yeah. Yeah.
She goes on to talk about how in the 1930s, John Dillinger famously had a doppelganger
who
was like arrested multiple times.
What?
It's literally like, well, what if she was tripping on acid? Like, let's just keep throwing out shit that could possibly explain this.
Yeah, what if she's a Russian spy? Fuck it.
All this is an attempt to moderate claims that she's lying, right? It's like, ooh, you actually don't need to believe that she's lying or crazy power hungry or whatever. We can sort of thread that needle and just say that she's mistaken, but the outcome is the same, right? We're still protecting our boy.
As in all of these things, the real problem is with the editors. The fact that people looked at this and were like, yes, let's put this in like one of the nation's most prestigious newspapers. Just fully just like wish casting of like, this might have happened. it's wild that no one, I mean, this is always my fucking issue with these columnists, is that like no one is like, hey, sorry, we really need some actual basis for this. They're like, well, you're a columnist with lifetime tenure.
The basis is that Brett Kavanaugh denied it. That's I'm now going to send you the closing paragraph.
Wait, I know. I was just about to Google and find the actual text of this, because I'm like, there's a little part of me that's like, this can't really be what she's doing, right? Like, it can't actually be this bad.
Trust me.
Okay, she says, thus, giving both the benefit of the doubt, it seems possible to believe both that Ford was assaulted just as she's described, and also that Kavanaugh didn't do it. In a case without evidence, witnesses, or corroboration, mistaken identity would provide a welcome resolution to this terrible riddle. Anyone? I love that she ends like, is this anything?
Cool rule of thumb. When you have to end a column by saying, anyone?
Anyone?
It's probably best to just not publish that column. You know? What this column should actually be titled is like, how I sleep at night while still supporting Brett Kavanaugh. Like, she says, okay, a case of mistaken identity would provide a welcome resolution to this terrible riddle. What's the riddle?
Yeah, the riddle is just they can't both be lying, but like, men lie about sexually assaulting women all the fucking time.
I love that what she's sort of implying almost is an alternate reality where Kavanaugh immediately confesses.
It's also weird. It's like she's doing this as if Blasey Ford was like assaulted in like a crowded subway car.
Right.
But like, she was in a small group. It was like a social event where she knew who was there. It was like a very finite number of people.
And she obviously feels confident enough that years later, she like stood up knowing that it would ruin her reputation. And those who aren't aware, like, she tried to keep her identity private in this because she knew she was going to get dragged in the mud, which of course she was.
Yeah, of course.
And then ultimately she got up there and testified. Like, that's how confident she felt.
Right.
You know, I know that people on the right sort of imagine that there are like rewards for people who accuse powerful men of sexual assault. But of course, the opposite is true. That's all incredibly strong evidence that she's confident about his identity.
Yeah.
And Kathleen Parker just can't hold those two thoughts at once. She needs to be able to support Brett Kavanaugh. And so she's just working her way there without going off the deep end like Matt Drudge.
This is me continuing to follow Azalea Banks on Instagram. I don't want to like her, but I still like her.
She's not always right. But when she's right,
Ooh, I know. You're like, fair enough, Azalea.
There's just so much going on here. You know, like, complete speculation being published as like a plausible theory, the theory itself being a way for her to like reassure herself that it's okay to support this man. And we are now, and like on top of that, you get in like this sort of implicit discrediting of a sexual assault victim.
It's also an acknowledgement that Kavanaugh's basically just like a generic white guy. She's like, yeah, everyone kind of looks like this fucking guy.
That is the strongest part of the argument.
Just
like, you know,
replacement level.
You could walk multiple Brett Kavanaughs by someone on the sidewalk, like one after another, and they wouldn't notice that it was weird. There's one more article I want to discuss. This one is actually from a couple months before the Kavanaugh one. This is July 3rd, 2018. As she's writing this, Anthony Kennedy has stepped down from the Supreme Court and he's going to be replaced by Trump. Brett Kavanaugh is the likely candidate, although there's been no like investigation, no opposition research onto him or anything. Mm. So we're just sort of in the early phases here. And she publishes this heater.
Oh, yeah. Classic stuff. She says, calm down. Roe v. Wade isn't going anywhere. God, there were so many of these, Peter. Jesus Christ.
This is one of the most prominent of this type. But first, does that headline read familiar to you?
Yeah. Calm down.
This is like the the tactic that like angry guys use when they're in a fight with their wives.
Is this the thing like Roberts won't destroy the reputation of the Supreme Court or whatever?
It's less sophisticated than that. Here's what's going on here, big picture. Anthony Kennedy was generally considered the fifth vote for Roe v. Wade. He was a supporter of it. And so he's stepping down. He's going to be replaced by Trump. Several legal analysts, notably Jeffrey Toobin, flagged the distinct possibility that Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned. Mm-hmm. She says, quote, what new justice would want to be that man or woman who forevermore would be credited with upending settled law and causing massive societal upheaval?
What? They would get more fishing trips to Wisconsin or whatever the fuck Clarence Thomas is doing. Why would someone not want to do that?
She says, quote, only Clarence Thomas would likely vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. Swing and a miss.
Ooh, Kathleen. Yeah, that's rough. That's rough.
This is someone who in 2018 thought that Sam Alito was a vote to uphold Roe v. Wade.
Sam Alito has like six Breitbart tabs open in his browser right now.
Right, right.
Like, how can you look at this guy and be like, no, he's a lock. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to send you another key paragraph here.
Oh my God. She says, many Americans, including some conservatives, would rather Trump not have access to the employee suggestion box, much less the Supreme Court. Then again, Gorsuch, whom he nominated upon taking office, is hardly a radical wingnut. And though true that Trump promised during his campaign to select justices who would send abortion back to the states, he doesn't actually get to dictate how they rule. Oh, this is again, like, although he says explicitly right. He wants to overturn Roe v. Wade, he's not going to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, that's why I like this paragraph so much, because once again, Donald Trump is saying something very specific. I'm going to select justices that will overturn Roe v. Wade. And she's like, no.
She says he doesn't get to dictate how they rule, which is true, but he does get to choose the justices. Whether or not they would rule to overturn Roe v. Wade is the litmus test for choosing
right.
them.
Right.
So it's like it's a distinction without a difference.
So there were columns, including one in the Washington Post itself, that were like, let's take a quick review of who was wrong about Roe v. Wade. They call out Kathleen Parker herself and they contact her and mm-hmm. they say, do you stand by it? And she says, and I quote, 100%.
What?
At the time it was written, it was accurate.
What?
It was on the nose.
The thing is, I can see standing by a wrong prediction if you're talking about like some sort of act of God. Like, I thought the next Marvel movie would make $1 billion, but then the coronavirus pandemic happened and nobody went to movies for 2 years. Something like that. Like, based on the information I had, I made the correct prediction. But that's not the case here. She had the previous decisions of these specific Supreme Court justices to go on, and she just got it wrong.
At the time that I said that you would not be stabbed, the knife-wielding maniac was 15 feet away from you. Here's the kicker, if you're ready for this one. Mm. Had the jackals of the abortion rights movement not protested at Kavanaugh's house, Parker said,
oh.
he might well have switched sides
oh,
in the Dobbs
off.
Case.
So it's the problem of the leftists.
So not only was I not wrong, but to the extent I was wrong, it's sort of your fault for being mean to Brett Kavanaugh, who, by the way, just happens to look like the guy who did a sexual assault back in 1982.
Maybe they didn't even protest in front of his house. Maybe it was just a guy that looked like him. Kathleen, follow it through.
That is sort of a rundown of my quintessential Kathleen Parker columns. I do want to be clear that although these are three of her most aggressively incorrect columns, she does have the sort of dumb bullshit that every other columnist does, too. And I'm just going to rattle off some headlines to give you a good sense. These are all from this year. Mm-hmm. First, a little crossover with a previous premium episode of ours. Mm-hmm. Bud Light started a fight it was bound to lose. Subheading, in a time of culturally encouraged identity confusion and gender fluidity, Anheuser-Busch tried to exploit a 26-year-old actress on TikTok. Shame on them.
Oh, my God. That's, again, the thing where she's trying not to be, like, out-and-out transphobic while, defending transphobes and, like, echoing a bunch of transphobic talking points.
All Bud Light did was partner up for, like, an Instagram promo with a trans influencer.
Yeah.
Kathleen Parker says that is exploiting a 26-year-old actress? How is that exploit? It's literally giving her money
just
in exchange for services.
Just giving her money to do ads. This is a normal...
I promise that is the last one that'll make you angry. The rest of them are just dumb. Dressing down for the Senate is just bad manners.
Oh, my fucking... I may have read this one.
Yeah, this, of course, is just about Senator Fetterman.
Yeah.
Subheading, senators should no more come to the chamber wearing a jogging suit than they should wear a tuxedo to play tennis.
What would she have said at your wedding, Peter? You came out in the tracksuit. She would have been livid. This is egregious.
That was the only reason I didn't invite her. Okay, some more headlines. Why I ordered 200 incandescent light bulbs.
What?
And that's just a story about how she likes incandescent light bulbs.
Okay. That one, I'll give her a pass. That when they're dumb but not harmful, just like, you know what? Have at it, Kathleen.
Here's one I like. Want to be happy? Then don't be a lawyer.
Ooh, that's true, Peter.
I mean, that's definitely true.
She could go on 5-4.
That's just a full column about a poll of lawyers that says that we're sad, which Of course, there's like 100 of those published every year.
Yeah.
The real superheroes of TV, the makeup artists.
Okay.
That's just about makeup artists.
Yeah, maybe we're watching the same tutorials.
That's really all I have for Kathleen Parker. I feel like she is very emblematic of like a type of very insulated, rich white person, you know,
yeah.
Like sort of moderately reactionary. On the other hand, not totally nuts. She was like very pro-mask and like wrote a lot about that during COVID and was very critical of Trump's response. But on the other hand, like she will never get behind trans rights.
Right.
Whenever partisan politics come to the front, she's pretty distinctly Republican.
Right. And this thing of blaming like left-wing activists for basically everything that the right wing does. I feel like this is another like very common trope in these columns.
And I think a lot of what makes her so shitty is that a lot of what she writes about when she really gets into substantive issues is just sort of like, oh, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a classic privileged person sort of position, because for her, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
Right. And it won't be bad basically no matter what happens.
I like that what qualifies for balance in like the nation's most prestigious opinion pages is like people who are comfortable in a mildly left-wing way and people who are comfortable in like a mildly right-wing way.
All right. We can do whoever yours is.
Okay. Are we on me now?
I think we are.
Okay. So I have kept this a secret from you. I'm doing a somewhat obscure pundit, although I don't actually know if this is obscure to you because you're like a Twitter super user and this is a person that got yelled at on Twitter constantly, which is how I first heard of him. So we are going to talk about Chris Cillizza.
Oh.
Are you familiar with Chris Cillizza?
Yeah. Of course I'm familiar with Chris Cillizza. He's now former CNN, right?
Yes.
And that is sort of where he spent the last, I don't know, what, several years?
Yeah, 2017 to 2022. Yeah.
This is a perfect pundit portrait because I have a sense of him.
Yes.
Which is that he's just sort of like a horse-brained sort of dummy who gives these sort of like middling hedging takes that are sort of like bizarrely critical of the left.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really know any actual details. I've never paid attention to him. It's true that I've seen him get dunked on Twitter quite a bit.
Dunking.
But I've never like dug in because he doesn't seem like the type of person that's worth digging into.
Well, I think this is like one of the core paradoxes of this show is that there's these people that just aren't that interesting to talk about, but also like his posts on the Washington Post would get 3 million views and he was one of the most popular pundits on CNN. So like these are worlds that just don't interest us very much.
Yeah.
Like TV news, commentary, like the fucking Sunday morning talk shows.
Right.
But also like we ignore it at our peril because like these fucking self-help books that we talk about, people like listen to these people.
I mean, I think we're still sort of just haunted by the fact that old people vote and young people don't. And like these people just have like the news on in their homes.
Yeah, just voices in the background.
And it's, you know, are you going to be a complete freak and have Fox News on? Or are you going to be just sort of a common dummy and have CNN on?
Whereas we get our news in a much more objective fashion where we just look at who's getting yelled at on Twitter today.
Absolutely.
Top story, Bean Dad. the whole nation is in an uproar.
I scroll my Twitter feed at 100 miles an hour, picking up keywords as I go. And then I stare out upon the New York City skyline and I just kind of feel what the vibes are. And that's how I absorb my news every day.
So Chris Cillizza is actually, it turns out, fairly interesting as a person. Grows up in Connecticut. It appears that he like grew up in like a fairly middle class family, but he also went to an elite boarding school whose name I forget and I don't care about. And he has no interest in politics. He gets into it because he gets an internship with George Will when he's in college. Mm-hmm. And the only reason he's even heard of George Will at the time is that George Will wrote a book about baseball.
Uh-huh.
And he's like a sports guy. And we talked about it briefly before, but like I think the rise of people like Chris Cillizza is part of this transformation of political journalism into essentially sports commentary.
Right.
After he works for George Will, he works for something called Roll Call, which is one of these like political who's up, who's down things. Then in 2005, he gets hired by the Washington Post and has a column called The Fix. He gets famous when he starts doing these videos for Washington Post of like who had the best and worst week in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
You remember this? And there's like a wheel that he spins and everything.
Yeah. I, man, this is this must have been when I was actually absorbing political nonsense like this
person.
as a young guy. I was living in D.C. for a bit after college and reading the hot blogs and absorbing trash into my brain.
So we're going to watch some of this trash.
Oh, God. Okay.
It's Friday, so let's see who had the worst week in Washington. The government shutdown stretched into its second week, and the blame game raged on between House Republicans, Senate Democrats, and President Obama. Now, I asked the Twitter sphere who they thought had the worst week in Washington and heard nominations like House Speaker John Boehner, Washington Redskins owner Dan Snyder, and my favorite, a 300 million way tie between all Americans. All strong guesses, but only one was close to the mark. Let's spin the wheel.
And then we have the wheel.
Good Lord.
The Republican Party. Instead of playing offense on the plagued rollout of Obamacare's health exchanges, the GOP spent the week in a defensive crouch looking for a way out of the political cul-de-sac they had driven themselves into. And now they've paid the price. An NBC Wall Street Journal poll put out late Thursday tells you everything you need to know. 53% of Americans blame congressional Republicans for the shutdown, and 70% disapprove of congressional Republicans overall. And here's the worst part. Many Republican strategists saw this coming. Polls showed it would be a disaster to tie the unpopular health care law to funding the government, but Republican leaders didn't, or maybe more accurately, couldn't, save themselves. So the grand old party, for being not so grand and for walking straight into a political trap, you had the worst week in Washington. Congrats! Or something.
It's absolutely excruciating. Okay. Oof. It's absolutely excruciating. I watched so many of these.
Brutal.
Yeah.
God, there's something about watching horse race political coverage.
I know.
Like a decade and change later.
The 2013 government shutdown. What were polls saying at the time?
Right. I feel like the 2011 one felt like a moment, like a political moment where you're like, ooh, what's going to happen? This is crazy. And now just every couple of years, there's like some sort of shut down shit. I barely even pay attention.
And every single time they're like, this is going to be a big issue in the next election. And then the minute it's over, everybody forgets about it.
Immediately.
Never comes up again.
This video is 10 years old and it has 146 views.
That's the thing. It's like you would never return to journalism like this.
Right.
It's like the Snapchat of political journalism.
This is just like polling in the ether. It's not necessarily reliable.
Right.
You're seeing the tiniest sliver of information.
Yeah.
And then someone is talking to you about that little sliver for 2 minutes. Like you have learned so close to nothing.
Yeah.
It's not even worth distinguishing.
I also open like 75 tabs of his like older columns.
I love the idea of the Michael Hobbs research work ethic being put into watching old clips of Chris Caliza.
This fucking nightmare.
Until your brain is a mush.
There were so many like weird little like political blips that like I've completely forgotten about. He has a column about Mitt Romney's Etch-a-Sketch gaffe. Do you even remember this?
He wrote a slur on an Etch-a-Sketch at the Iowa State Fair or whatever.
No, it was just this tedious thing where he's running against a bunch of Republicans in the primary. And then one of his advisors told, I don't know, Politico or fucking somebody that like now that he's running in the general, he's going to be an Etch-a-Sketch and we're going to change the way that he presents himself to the American public.
Uh-huh.
And this was like in some way a gaffe or like admitting that he was phony or something. It's funny looking back on these things because you're like, did we talk about this for like a whole fucking week? And like, yes, we did.
I will say something in defense of the stupid political news cycle of like a decade ago. Dragging that story out a week is not any more rational than what we do now, which is talk about one of those stories for 10 minutes and then move on to the next one. Now you'll go into work and be like, hey, did you hear what Mitt Romney's advisor said? And your colleague will be like, Joe Biden ate a baby on camera yesterday.
Right.
And they're suppressing the footage.
He also has a column called Obama the Aggressive, where he talks about a speech that Obama gave where he's like talking about his jobs plan. And he says, Obama was anything but the compromiser in chief tonight. He was an aggressive advocate for action and someone who might not pick a fight, but certainly wouldn't back away from one. To the extent that the speech has a lasting impact, it will be to harden, or at least more clearly delineate, the lines of disagreement between Democrats and Republicans on the economy.
I'm going to move my recording booth outside so that I can jump off the balcony if I need to
at any
point.
And just fucking scream.
There's so much going on here. First of all, this is the lowest form of commentary, is doing presidential speech commentary.
Yes, theater criticism.
A president does a prepared speech, and then you're like, what did I learn? Fucking nothing, dude, because it was like a staged presentation, and you're watching it. It's so weird to think that you can actually get real information out of it.
It's basically theater for the purpose of columns like this.
Right.
Syliza is playing a role in this kind of agreement between politicians and political media, where Obama is like, I want to give a speech where I seem aggressive. And like, I'm really not going to back down from this. And then Syliza just swallows it and is like, he's not going to back down from this. He's really aggressive about getting people to pass his jobs plan.
It's literally like Obama's on a stage and he smiles and Chris Caliza is like, Obama is happy.
Yeah.
And then he like makes a stern face. He's like, Obama is serious.
So I'm going to zoom in on one of his most controversial columns, and basically the way that he comes to national prominence as like a symbol of where journalism went wrong. So in 2014, this is during the rollout of healthcare.gov and all the botching, and this is after this sort of Tea Party election. This is early 2014, so it's a midterm election year, but it's before the sort of campaigning has begun in earnest. So in February, the CBO puts out a report about like how the healthcare.gov website and like how it got botched, how that is going to affect the projections for like Americans getting healthcare.
Okay.
So according to the CBO report, the botched rollout is going to reduce signups for Obamacare by 1 million people, and it's going to reduce jobs in the economy by 2 million.
Okay.
And so Syliza writes a piece called The Worst Headline for Democrats This Year, and I'm going to send you the main part of it.
Close your eyes for a minute and fast forward to October, and imagine yourself sitting in a Charlotte hotel room watching TV, and this ad comes on. Kay Hagan voted for Obamacare, a law whose rollout was so botched that a million people decided to not even sign up for health coverage. And the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says Obamacare will cost America 2 million jobs. Kay Hagan voted wrong. Now it's time to vote her out. That's a very tough hit on any Democratic incumbent who voted for the Affordable Care Act. God.
So things are bad. Things are bad for the Democrats.
Imagine yourself sitting in a Charlotte hotel room watching TV is just... I love Chris Caliza trying to imagine a normal human being.
Yeah, and he's like,
where are you? You're in a hotel room?
Yeah, why am I in a hotel watching this? Why aren't I in my living room?
Someone who's in a hotel in Charlotte probably doesn't live in North Carolina, Chris. Just FYI, when you're in a hotel, you don't live in that city almost every time.
So this is like sort of three paragraphs in. He's talking about sort of how bad this looks for Democrats, etc. He then, in the very next paragraph, notes that when Republicans do all of these attack ads on Democrats in my Charlotte hotel room, they will be lying. Because that's not meaningfully what the CBO report says.
Right.
The CBO report does not say that like a million people are not going to sign up for Obamacare. All they're saying is that the people who are signing up for Obamacare, those will be a little bit delayed.
Uh-huh.
It's not that people are going to miss out on health coverage. It's just going to take a little bit longer.
And then
this thing about like losing 2 million jobs, the way that this is framed is like the Obamacare is going to cost 2 million jobs. But first of all, the American economy has 160 million jobs. So 2 million is actually not a very big impact to begin with. It's like a little bit over 1%. And what the CBO report actually says is that the subsidies of Obamacare are structured so that if you work more hours, your subsidies get reduced. So if you're working like 35 hours at Walmart, you might be getting like a $500 subsidy. But then if you work 40 hours at Walmart, you'll end up spending $600 on your health insurance. So for some people, it won't actually make sense for them to increase their hours at their jobs.
Right.
And for some families, it's the same kind of thing. If you have a couple different people in your family or a household, it might not make sense for somebody to join the labor force for maybe 10 hours or something, get a part-time job, because your subsidies will go down.
I mean, there might be like a negative impact on productivity, for example, but that could also be rephrased as like, this will save some families time and money.
Exactly. And they will keep their health care.
Right.
So this isn't people losing jobs, and this isn't people losing health care.
So basically all he's doing is like twisting around the conclusions of this CBO report and being like, well, what if Republicans lied about this?
That would
be bad for Democrats.
What's amazing to me about people like Chris Ciliza is that he knows it's bad faith, right? In his own column, he's like, oh, this isn't actually going to cost anybody their job. And this like 1 million thing, it's like kind of a timeline thing. But he, after he like explains this, he actually explains it quite poorly. He just includes a really long paragraph from the actual CBO report. Yeah,
there's no way he understands it. He's just like, he just has a general sense that it's not, that's not what's going on.
He's like, warning, jargon ahead.
Right.
Why don't you just explain it without the jargon then, Chris?
Warning, I don't understand what I'm about to copy and paste.
So this column became quite controversial and I think massively increased the prominence of this critique of this kind of journalism, that it's basically sports. I just want to kind of walk through this critique a little bit, just because like we've sort of danced around it on the show, but I don't think we've like laid out the argument all that clearly. So the emergence of this critique of political journalism in this way started, it's kind of been around for a while, but the most prominent critique was a cover story in The Atlantic by James Fallows in 1996 called Why Americans Hate the Media, which is wonderful. And like, I return to it constantly. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It's really good.
I was assigned this as like a political science major.
Oh, yeah.
Just sort of like, here's, you know, here's this prominent critique of political media.
I mean, it's aged like fucking wine. Like it is completely true. And these critiques, it's fascinating to me that these critiques have been around for so long. So the sort of starting point for this critique of the media is basically that when you do these like town hall style meetings with actual voters, they ask very different questions than journalists do. So he's talking about a town hall meeting between Bill Clinton and a bunch of like teens. It's like a youth summit thing. And these are the questions that the actual teenagers asked. We need stronger laws to punish people who are caught selling guns to our youth. What can you do about that? We need more police officers who are trained to deal with all the different cultures in our cities. Programs designed to keep teenagers away from drugs and gangs oftentimes emphasize sports and seem geared mainly to boys. How can such programs be made more attractive to teenage girls?
Uh-huh.
So it's basically like, how will politics affect my life? Mm-hmm. He then contrasts that with interviews with politicians. So I'm going to send this to you.
Dan Rather did interviews through January with prominent politicians. Every question he asked was about popularity or political tactics. He asked Phil Graham to guess whether Newt Gingrich would enter the race and whether Bill Clinton would be renominated by his party. He asked Bob Dole what kind of mood the president seemed to be in, and whether Dole and Gingrich were, in effect, the new bosses of Washington. When Edward Kennedy began giving his views about the balanced budget amendment, Rather steered him back on course. Senator, you'd know I'd talk about these things the rest of the afternoon, but let's move quickly to politics. Do you expect Bill Clinton to be the Democratic nominee for re-election in 1996?
Right. Once you see this pattern, you see it everywhere when like they do these atrocious White House press briefings or whatever. It's like, how are you going to appeal to like white working class voters? It's this like meta stuff.
Right. I also want to just flag briefly that it's very interesting that they were doing this like, will the current president be nominated for a second term by his party, even with Bill Clinton, like a historically popular president?
It's like how every 4 years we get takes about how like, will this be the first brokered convention?
Yeah, right, right.
So then James Fallows follows this up in 1998 with a book called Breaking the News, which is also very good. He traces the sort of the history of this style of journalism. I mean, there's a million contributing factors, but a big one is this sort of, you know, the fake journalistic objectivity. This is something that basically grew out of the penny press as newspapers started, rather than selling publications to readers, they started selling readers to advertisers, and they needed to have a mass audience. Mm-hmm. And so to appeal to everybody, you can't seem like you're in the tank for one party or the other. So they started doing this objective style in sort of the late 1800s. He also talks about the professionalism of journalism, that as it basically became a more white-collar profession than a blue-collar profession. And so it tends to reflect the sensibilities of like educated, relatively affluent professionals. And then that gave rise to right-wing critiques that the media had a liberal bias.
Uh-huh.
You also have, of course, like the post-Watergate fall in trust in public institutions.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
have these books like The Selling of the President, 1968, and What It Takes, these things that kind of talk about like marketing political figures. I think this kind of contributes to the sense that politics is a form of theater. And I think readers wanted to be reassured that, like, well, I'm not one of the people who's a target of this theater. I'm somebody who's kind of behind the scenes and, like, yeah. I'm participating yeah. in the making of that theater. I think a lot of this is, like, designed to make people feel smart.
That immediately clocks for me.
Yeah.
You know, I lived in DC for a bit. You go to fucking parties and everyone's talking about this shit, right? It's a way to talk about politics and seem savvy.
This critique then, I mean, this is the late 1990s when this shows up, which is interesting because it's pre-internet. And I think the internet has made all of this so much fucking worse because there's like even more commentary.
Yeah.
This critique starts to get more prominence and gets taken up by Jay Rosen, who's a professor at NYU, I believe. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he calls this the savvy style in U.S. politics. And so he says, savviness is being shrewd, practical, hyper-informed, perceptive, ironic, with it, and unsentimental in all things political. Prohibited from joining in political struggles, dedicated to observing what is regardless of what ought to be, the savvy believe that these disciplines afford them a special view of the arena, cured of excess sentiment, useless passion, ideological certitude, and other defects of vision that the players in the system routinely exhibit. The savvy don't say, I have a better argument than you. They say, I am closer to reality than you.
Right. And I think part of that presentation is that, like, people who are too focused on policy are in a way naive.
Yeah.
For example, if you work for a nonprofit that wants to expand affordable housing, you're never going to get your actual policy proposal implemented because of politics, right?
Right.
There's too much politics in the way. So the real savvy thing would be to understand the politics, right?
Yeah.
You know, why waste your time understanding what the best policy is going to be when it's never going to happen anyway, right?
Right.
There's sort of like this weird, circular, almost self-fulfilling sort of reasoning there.
So to return to my 75 open tabs, another issue with this savvy style as practiced by Chris Saliza is that a lot of this kind of work is just dumb.
Mm-hmm.
So like he has a column on, I'm sure you remember this one, Mitt Romney's like 47% gaffe during the 2012 election.
Oh yeah, that one I remember.
So this is Chris Saliza's alleged analysis of this.
The conventional wisdom is that 47% hurt so much because it played directly into the stereotype of Romney as an out-of-touch rich guy that President Obama and his campaign were playing up. And that's true. But there's more there when it comes to why the comments were so incredibly damaging. The truly terrible thing for Romney was that the remarks not only came directly out of Romney's mouth, but were also documented on video.
Again, this is not really analysis. It's like, yeah, it was more harmful that like you could see and hear him saying this.
Well, yes, of course. I don't even understand. Yes, it's this is weird because he's just describing the elements of the scandal. Like what was so bad about this statement is that Mitt Romney said it. It's like, well, if he didn't, then there wouldn't be a scandal. The scandal is that he said it. I don't even understand.
He has a whole column about Sarah Palin going on the Today Show where he's like, the lesson from this is that she needs the media. She uses the media to get her message out.
Mm.
And you're like, yes, Chris, that that's just like the fundamental structure.
Right, just the basic structure of politics.
That's why it's called the media. It's a medium through which messages flow. Like this is really like Wikipedia level shit.
We're not going to find anything better than to like, the real scandal was that he said this. Yeah. This is such a weird, it's not even analysis. It's just like explaining
words from his mouth,
how like human communication works.
Also I pulled this one specifically for you, Peter, because this is about the Supreme Court. So in 2012, he publishes a column called John Roberts, umpire. He says this.
In John Roberts' opening statement in his 2005 confirmation hearing, he uttered the following lines. I will remember that it's my job to call balls and strikes and not to pitch or bat.
Good name for a website.
Today, he served as the swing vote in a 5-4 ruling that largely upheld President Obama's health care law and handed the incumbent a major political boost. In doing so, Roberts made good on his pledge to referee the game, not play it. What Roberts did, whether intentionally or not, in ruling that Obamacare is constitutional, is to remind people of two things. One, trying to cover the Supreme Court through the same partisan lens we cover campaigns and congressional politics is inherently flawed. Oof, deep breath.
Yeah.
And two, he meant what he said during his confirmation hearing almost 7 years ago.
Just a referee out here.
You know what you were doing sending me this, and I'm
I know.
Pissed. I'm pissed.
Get you an ulcer. Yes.
God damn it. Okay. All right. This obviously conjures up a lot of feelings and thoughts. I'm just going to say one. Okay. Mm-hmm. The idea behind John Roberts saying, I call balls and strikes, I'm just an umpire, is obviously him saying that, like, I'm going to, in a non-biased fashion, analyze the law. What Kaliza is highlighting here is the actual opposite of that, which is John Roberts locating what he thought would be the best maneuver politically for the court.
He was a political actor, yes.
Right. It's literally, God damn it.
I know.
Makes me so mad that people seem to believe moderation is the same thing as, like, objective analysis.
Right.
First of all, there is no such thing as objective analysis of the law, blah, 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 listen to 5 to 4. But what's really detached about this is that to the extent you believe that objective analysis of the law exists, this is distinctly not it.
Yeah.
I mean, this is why for so long people thought that Roberts was, like, a master of his craft. Because he clearly understood that just the smallest amount of effort could just get these, you know, sort of DC punditry types on a string dancing exactly how he wants them to dance.
You can say blowjob. You can say giving him a blowjob. It's fine, Peter. It's fine. You can make problematic comparisons.
No, I prefer to view John Roberts as a puppeteer and Chris Kaliza as a little puppet.
The real reason the gaffe was so bad is because John Roberts wrote it down on a piece of paper and other people read it. Wow, that's the real, that's my analysis of this.
You told me in the beginning that Chris Kaliza started off not interested in politics. And now I'm starting to see that that is something that he carried with him, a complete lack of interest in politics.
But then what is amazing, and the reason I wanted to dive into this is because there was this huge blow up about this CBO column that he wrote about the healthcare.gov rollout. And afterwards he wrote a follow-up piece and a series, he actually had a series of, like, debates about this kind of journalism. And this is one of the few times that we've had somebody who does horse race journalism actually respond to the critiques. I think it's important to see sort of as a second order exercise, like, okay, Chris Kaliza has received all of these critiques. How is he responding to them?
Yeah.
So a couple of weeks later, he publishes an article called Why the CBO Report is Still Bad News for Democrats. He has a couple of points to defend himself. So first he says, I can already hear people saying some version of this. It's your job in the media to inform people, to tell people what's right and what's wrong, to cut through the clutter. Absolutely true. And that's why I included the actual language from the CBO report in my initial reporting and why I think Glenn's post is so valuable. So he's referring to a fact checker column by the Washington Post fact checker guy, Glenn Kessler, who sort of summarizes, like, the actual facts of the CBO report. So he's basically saying, like, other people will be doing this. I'm not. It's not my job to to do that. It's other people's job to do that.
Yeah, Glenn's our fact guy. Here at the Post, there's, 150 people in the newsroom, and then we got Glenn, who's in charge of facts.
So there's kind of this blow up, and then he also gets another wave of criticism about his coverage of Hillary Clinton for, like, the email stuff, which, like, I don't want to go into again.
Let's just insert the full Hillary Clinton emails episode at this point in the episode.
And we're back. he prints, to his credit, he prints in full an actual, like, an email debate that he has with Norm Ornstein, who is a political scientist who wrote this infamous column being like, let's just say it, the Republicans are the problem with American politics. It's not polarization, it's the Republicans. Mm-hmm. Norm Ornstein is one of the people criticizing this kind of horse race coverage, especially in the 2016 election. And so again, Chris Kaliza, like, responds to this critique. So I'm going to send you this.
You argue that the coverage has been stupid because it is focused more on her emails and the Clinton Foundation than on policy proposals. But isn't that your own view of what people care about when they vote? That they necessarily prize policy and issue positions over resume and what each of the candidates have said and done in the past? I'm a big believer that the key to covering the presidential campaign is to have a goal of showing voters who the people running for the highest office in the country actually are, beyond the talking points, beyond the prepackaged policy proposals. To me, how a candidate has acted in the past, particularly when fewer people were looking at them, or how they think on their feet when questioned by the media, are essential to understanding who these people really are. Therefore, covering some of the things you describe as stupid strikes me as far more important as a window into how she thinks, how she acts, and who she is.
I love the phrase prepackaged policy proposals.
Legislation, that's all pre-written.
The way she's going to affect your life. Yes, let's get beyond that stuff.
How does she handle fainting in public? That's yes. What I want to focus on.
And this is also something that James Fallows actually mentions in Breaking the News, is that one of the contributing factors to this is the rise of TV news, and especially sort of tabloid-ish coverage of politics as human interest story. Kind of like what we talked about with that Nancy Pelosi article, where it's like, how does she feel now that she's no longer in power, right? Covering them as sort of celebrities. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think it's fair enough to point out that there is a lot of interest in that. But I think people like Syliza wildly overestimate how relevant it is for public policy. Like, maybe Hillary Clinton is a fucking terrible person and she supports a $12 minimum wage simply because, like, that's the way public opinion is moving and, like, she doesn't give a shit. Or maybe she supports a $12 minimum wage because, like, she's a really good person and, like, her heart breaks for the working poor in America every single night. The kind of person she is only really relevant for determining her motivation. It's not relevant for determining what she's actually going to do.
Right. What's the best evidence about what kind of person she is?
Yeah.
For our purposes, it's what she did with power when she had it. And we have tons of that information.
The final defense that Chris Syliza makes of his kind of journalism is, I also think there's a kernel of truth here. I'm going to send this to you.
I can't tell you the number of times people have emailed, tweeted, or told me on the street that we need to do more accountability journalism and fact-checking of Trump. When I point out the fact that we have fact-checked Trump more than other candidates, have written deeply about everything from Trump University to the Trump Foundation to his pledges about building a wall, they sort of don't get it. I think what a lot of people want to know is why our fact-checks and our deep dives into Trump U, etc., aren't changing people's minds about him.
So I think this is a good point. I think people push their critique onto the media of, like, why aren't you guys doing more to, like, make people hate this guy? Like, why are people still voting for this fucking guy?
Yeah.
It's this idea that is, like, very tempting of, like, well, if people had the information that he's lying, they wouldn't be voting for him.
Right. And, you know, I think Trump was able to lean on, like, alternative conservative media to drive a narrative that he was the target of a smear campaign by liberal media, which meant that liberal media's sort of efforts to criticize him ended up being sort of fruitless because they almost feed into his own narrative about himself and about what's happening to him.
Exactly.
There's the essence of, like, a real defense here by Clizza, but what he's sort of avoiding discussing is how particularly stupid his own coverage is.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, even by the standards of horse race coverage, it's, like, bad horse race coverage.
Right. I mean, it's also obscene to argue that there's just the right amount of horse race coverage in American political media. It's way too much, too much.
But then I ultimately found Chris Syliza to be, like, a really tragic figure. So he's laid off from CNN in 2022. It's not totally clear why. My understanding was that he was, like, quite popular. And so I don't really know why they laid him off. He has, you know, he's a guy with a Substack now. He has a YouTube channel of his own. He still does kind of freelance commentary for CNN every once in a while. But what's amazing, if you look at, like, his Substack and, like, the videos that he makes now, is, like, he doesn't do this shit anymore. Huh. So he has a video about, like, the upcoming election where he's like, you know, there's been critiques of Biden's age and also critiques of Donald Trump, like, fomenting an insurrection. And anyone who compares those two things to each other and says that they're equivalent is lying to you. Trump is, like, unprecedented, and he's staging an assault on democracy.
Uh-huh.
This is what is so interesting to me is, like, I don't know if he was getting pressure from editors or, like, how it worked. But it's like the minute he's not ensconced in these institutions, he just, like, accepts the critique and just acts differently.
I also think that it just took a lot of these dipshits 4 years of Trump to really process him.
Yeah.
Like, you see it with Kathleen Parker, too. Again, by the end of Trump's term, she was like, okay, he is different in a bad way from a median politician on the right.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that was just something that it took January 6th, maybe, for a lot of people to process. Or maybe not January 6th, but just sort of the his general adversarial position towards democratic processes.
Yeah.
You know, they're slow learners. They're little baby brains, you know?
But still, the biggest twist of this episode is that clip that I showed you earlier. That actually wasn't Chris Saliza. That was Brett Kavanaugh. Anyone?
Anyone?